Welcome to the WPS Remix Edition of the Plastic Surgery Hot Seat Podcast, presented by the ASPS Women Plastic Surgeons Forum. I'm Dr. Paige Myers, Clinical Assistant Professor at the University of Michigan, and I'm excited to share the latest pearls and pitfalls in aesthetic and reconstructive breast, body, and facial surgery straight from the WPS Symposium.
Hello, I am Carrie Campbell. I'm a plastic surgeon in private practice in Memphis, Tennessee. And today I am joined by Sarah Dickey to discuss her wonderful presentation called You Need a Facelift, or Do You? Negotiating Patient Goals and Managing Your Own Expectations in Facial Aesthetics. She just presented that today at the WPS Symposium. Sarah, will you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you?
Sure. I practice in Morton Grove, Illinois. I have a general plastic surgery practice. I practice on face and body. I do some reconstructive and aesthetics, but my great passion and joy is facial aesthetics.
Great. So for people listening, can you sort of recap what you feel like were the main points that you were trying to get across to the audience today?
Absolutely. The thing with facial aesthetics is it is really a continuum. It's a very, very broad field, as you can imagine. I mean, everyone is looking at their own face all the time, myself personally. And so when I see patients who've decided to make the leap to come and speak to me as a physician about their goals and what they see in the mirror and how it's not matching up with how they feel inside or their concerns, I wanted to talk to the audience a bit about my interpretation of that consultation and how to help meet expectations and also how to plan for myself to have less complications and maybe less confusion on the patient's part and myself about where we're going and what our goals are.
Great. So you showed us patients and said some of the patients who walked in your office, you felt like they needed a facelift, but they really didn't want a facelift. And so you showed us really impressive results with doing their neck alone or doing their neck and their eyes. Can you talk to me about, do you feel like the patients that you showed us would have benefited from more? You know, like how do you plan that as a practitioner? You know, what do you say to those patients?
Right. Well, I think it's the hard part, or maybe the wonderful part, is that I'm constantly learning. I've been amazed at how many patients I thought you need a facelift, or perhaps the only thing that will get you to your goal is a facelift. But for one reason or another, the patient was not ready for that surgery and wanted to limit it either because of cost or time of recovery or what they actually saw as the problem, you know, more focused on their eyes or more focused on the excess skin in the middle of their neck. And so I'm negotiating with them about, you know, what risk they're willing to take and how much they're willing to go through or how much they're willing to pay. And so, you know, I've been surprised at how much can be done offering different approaches to people. So I always start a conversation or a consultation with the patient, just really trying to understand what it is that is bothering them the most. And if they can sort of put it into words and point out to me what that is, I can go about creating a plan for them that might include multiple different pathways. You know, here's one option, a complete facelift. Or if you want to take a different route and address just your eyes at the start, we can do that because we can do your face later or your neck later if you want to save money. You know, as they say, there's more than one way to skin a cat. You know, there's more than one way to address facial aesthetics and facial surgeries, and especially given the plethora of minimally invasive procedures, fillers and injectables and things like that. Sometimes you can temporize people and they may not need surgery at all and may be able to just do some non-surgical approaches. And so being able to give patients an idea or a menu of options really gives them the power of making that choice and I think feeling a lot more comfortable with the process.
Can you talk to us about how your technique with the neck lift has evolved from the beginning of your practice to where you are today?
Absolutely. So initially, you know, when I started doing neck lifts, and I sort of talked about this at the beginning of my talk, I started, you know, in pediatric plastic surgery, doing a lot of facial reconstruction for giant nevi. And that was, you know, we would pre-expand the skin. And so it was all skin surgery that I was used to doing. And so I would approach adult necks or aesthetic necks, you know, sort of aimed at the skin, but really realized very quickly about how important the platysma was. And again, the SMAS, it's sort of like the evolution of the SMAS and the facelift. And so really utilizing the structure of the platysma to define the neck and letting the skin drape over that, not relying on the skin to do any of the heavy lifting. I think it keeps my scars a lot nicer and much more predictable. As well, I now routinely, and some might call this, you know, more of a, just more of a lower facelift, but taking a transposition flap from in front of the ear, since I already have a skin flap elevated there, and transposing that posteriorly to just help support the skin under the earlobe and help prevent some of the risks of pixie ear or any scarring defects that can happen around the earlobe and can be a bit of a telltale sign that someone has had facial surgery.
So are you raising a strip of SMAS mm-hmm. entirely in front of the ear?
I am, yeah. So usually, you know, the skin elevation for a neck lift goes maybe 2 centimeters in front of the ear, you know, over the angle of the mandible. And under the neck, and that exposes a perfect amount of SMAS. And when you move the skin, oftentimes that SMAS will kind of fold in on itself. It's kind of asking to be resected. And I started actually just excising it. And I just didn't want the redundancy under my skin. I wanted the skin to lie flat. And then one time I was resecting it and I
started to pop down.
Right, swept it behind the ear. And I was like, oh, that's nice. I mean, I'm sure it's described somewhere, and many people describe it as part of their high SMAS facelift or you know, various facelift techniques, but I hadn't seen it described solely in the neck. But I do it, and I'm really happy with how it helps.
And patients, so you described that there's some patients that you do their neck, and then they're happy, and then come back 5-10 years later,
sure.
They're like, okay, now I'm ready to do my face. If you do that technique, do you have trouble finding the SMAS when you go back? Is it much more interior to the ear than you would expect it to be because you've done that, or does it approximate very nicely?
So I have not gone back that far later. I've gone back a bit sooner, and I found that the skin flap elevates nicely, but the SMAS doesn't seem to be missing, again, because I'm only taking about a centimeter width transposition flap, and I'm closing the donor site or the defect. So the SMAS is still there, and typically it still has more laxity, and that's what I'm saying. It's not really a lower facelift as much because I'm not undermining the SMAS at all or advancing the SMAS in the face as much as I'm tucking it along the mandibular angle and behind the ear to better support that just that area right below the lobe.
Yeah, it really chisels or
yes.
contours the jawline
yes.
and supports your lobe. Do you have any tips or tricks aside from that to avoid the pixie ear?
So, I mean, as it's classically described, not overly suturing the area. I mean, I think it does really help to have the area heal a little bit by secondary intent. Although I've had issues with that where there's a little bit of hypertrophic scarring. So while you don't have a pixie ear, you might have a hypertrophic scar, which you'll either be excising or injecting. But what I think is vitally important, and I said this in my talk, is not relying on the skin to really hold anything. Even if I've trimmed the skin around where the lobe will be inset and it seems like it is separated from the ear, it's not laying perfectly below the under the lobe or tucked under the lobe, even if I put a deep stitch in there to hold it, that stitch will dissolve and the skin will retract. So I need the SMAS and the platysma to be holding the skin in place.
Okay, great. I thank you for taking the time to answer questions for me. It was really great to hear from you today.
Thank you.
I think the audience really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Thank you.
Here today with Cindy McCord, who's also a fellow Tennessean with me, to discuss her presentation that she gave at WPS today. It was called Anything He Can Do, She Can Do Better. It's time to show our fabulous aesthetic facial results, ladies. So Cindy, please introduce yourself and tell everyone a little bit about your practice.
Yeah, so I'm Cindy McCord. I have a solo practice in Chattanooga, Tennessee that is primarily focused on cosmetic aesthetic surgery and in particular on facial aesthetics.
All right, great. So Cindy, I have to admit that I am a deep plane facelift person, so we may have differing opinions on things. You made a specific comment today. You said that you felt that nowadays, or something of that variety, that the need for the deep plane facelift isn't really there anymore. And I would love to know what you feel like has caused that pivot in your, maybe in your practice or in general practice, why you say, you know, nowadays type of thing.
So I think one of the biggest reasons is the adding on of fat grafting to our facial procedures. You know, and before fat grafting came about, it was more releasing all those deep ligaments and then resuspending the tissues, but not quite getting them to where they need to be. And you know, there was sort of this lack of fullness, especially in the midface area, that started to come about. And there's many surgeons, including myself, who have sort of just tinkered around with these different procedures and have come to realize that you don't need to be so invasive, because we can move the tissue and then supplement with fat grafting or other ancillary procedures to try to get the same result.
Okay, great. And can you tell the audience at home sort of what your general technique is for a facelift and what those ancillary procedures are that you enjoy doing?
So I incorporate a thicker than normal subcutaneous and skin flap. And then my second layer would be consistent with the SMAS. And in using those two different layers, and sort of opposing vectors or in conjunction with one another, I just feel you can get a better elevation than if you were just doing like a skin lift only, which is sort of antiquated at this point.
And when you do your lift, do you use permanent sutures? How do you suspend the face?
So all of my muscle suspension, plication, including the SMAS and the platysma, is done with Marceline sutures. A 3-0 or 4-0, depending on sort of the thickness of the overlying skin flap, and then also the integrity and the thickness of the muscle that I'm trying to resuspend. And then as far as facial skin closure, I use a combination of 4-0 monocryls in a deeper layer and then a running 6-0 proline on the epidermal for reapproximation in the epidermis. And then in the hair area, obviously staples.
Can you talk to us about your post-op care of your patients and what you feel like helps their recovery the best?
So I'm a firm believer that there needs to be some type of post-operative garment that's incorporated into the recovery itself. I know there are quite a few people out there who don't utilize garments. They believe in icing and sort of different techniques. But for me, with the level of opening that I'm doing in most of my lower face and neck lifts, there just has to be something that's guiding that tissue into the perfect location so that it heals in the right spot. So by the combination of using neck garments, the sort of nylon elastic neck garments, and then having them not flexing, hyperextending, and not rotating side to side when they're sleeping or even doing their everyday activities, I just think it adds that extra little layer of protection to get that skin to sort of hitch up right underneath of the chin and increase that nice cervicomental angle.
How often do you open the anterior neck?
I open almost every single neck in the middle. There's just, for me, it seems regardless of how thin the patient is, there's always going to be that small amount of fat that you just cannot get or cannot access, you know, well enough by just doing liposuction with cannula. So I almost always open that to get that fat out and then do some sort of platysmal tightening. You know, some people have a wider decussation than others, but for me, I think any degree of tightening in the middle compounded with that lateral pull is going to give you kind of more of that flattening that we all desire right underneath the submental area.
So, can you talk to me a little bit about how you use liposuction in the face and neck at all stages of your patient's life? You know, do you find that it's helpful with, in conjunction with the facelift? You kind of mentioned that, or do you offer to younger patients, and what is your counseling to them about choosing liposuction as an option?
Yeah, so I think it's a great option for people who are in that, you know, 20, 30, 40 age bracket that may have an isolated bit of fat that's just a little bit too much to be controlled with something like Kybella. I think that they're a great candidate to undergo the submental liposuction. And then as they get older, unfortunately, I always counsel them that you're going to develop some sort of skin laxity. When they're younger and they get the liposuction, normally that skin is going to snap back a lot better, but there's going to be that rare person where it may not. And so then they may be forced, you know, as decades progress, to be put into a situation where then we have to address more of the skin laxity instead of the fatty tissue there. But I'm a, you know, a huge proponent of liposuction when it's done cautiously. I've seen a lot of over-resected necks, unfortunately, centrally, especially. So we don't want to have the cobra necks walking around, and you just got to be cautious. I like to leave about, you know, a good 2 millimeter or so layer of subcutaneous tissue underneath of the neck skin itself to avoid that over-processed or over-resected look.
And then one last question. Do you, can you talk about the evolution of your facelift technique and sort of where you started and where you've ended up now?
Yeah, so in training, in general, I learned mostly a sort of non-invasive or minimally invasive technique that I utilize today. And therefore, I thought it was so important when I was outside of training that I had to learn a deep plane facelift. So I taught myself, you know, in going to many panels at ASPS and other conferences, reading textbooks, watching the videos on ASPS and the video sort of CDs that accompany some of the bigger textbooks out there, I kind of taught myself how to do a deep plane. And, you know, it was gut-wrenching to me to have to deal with that and think about all the structures that you don't want to harm, but yet you have to get them out of the way in order to get that good elevation of tissue. So I taught myself how to do it. And then as time progressed, I was spending more time than I needed to just trying to get that plane developed. And I just sort of thought to myself, well, I'm just moving muscle. So why do I have to go that deep? And why do I have to lift up all that tissue if I can do the same thing by just tightening the muscle with some suture suspension? And then it sort of evolved back into what I had originally learned in training. So it's almost like I had this progression and then recession back into what I was originally taught. And that's currently how I practice today, doing a less invasive form.
Okay, great. Well, maybe I need to reconsider.
Oh, I don't know. Trust me. I mean, I have nothing against people that do the deep plane. There's fantastic results out there. I'm just sort of kind of trying to promote that, hey, we don't have to always do the most invasive thing, and we can get similar results.
Yeah. And you can tailor it to your patient, too.
Exactly. Yep.
All right. Well, great. Thank you so much, Cindy.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm here with Anu Bajaj discussing her wonderful talk she just gave called IQ, Blepharoplasty Tips and Tricks from the 2023 WPS Symposium. Anu, will you introduce yourself and tell everybody a little bit about your practice?
So I'm Anu Bajaj, and I'm in solo private practice in Oklahoma City. I've been there since 2007, and when I started my practice 15 years ago, I was primarily doing breast reconstruction and doing breast micro. And since 2014, 2015, I've transitioned my practice to the point where last year I was 90% aesthetic, and this year I'm going to be close to 100%. So I'm not doing that much reconstruction anymore.
Great. Well, I hope you enjoy the change in your practice. I know that can be satisfying to be able to control how you spend your days and really feel like you're directing how your practice is going forward. I know that's got to be really satisfying. So congratulations.
It is. It's interesting because I had always said I probably wouldn't do micro after I was 50.
Yeah.
And I'm 54 now. So I'm getting to that point. But I just think that it's something that not everybody can do forever.
Yeah. So tell everyone a little bit, just a recap of what you've, your evolution of your blepharoplasty has been and what you discussed today during your panel.
So today for the panel, my talk focused mainly on my approach to upper and lower lid blephs. My approach generally has been to keep it simple, and I've gradually evolved my practice, but for my upper lid blephs, I primarily do skin muscle excision and a little bit of fat removal from the medial pocket. And then for my lower lid blephs, I'm a traditionalist with a skin muscle flap, lateral canthopexy, and temporary tarsorrhaphy sutures.
So you also discussed the importance of considering your brow position with your breath. And can you talk to me about your brow lift technique and what you feel like works in your hands? I have to admit that I feel like as a surgeon, I'm struggling to decide what brow lift works because it's
brow lifts are a struggle. And I do think that a lot of the patients that we see don't even realize the fact that their brows are ptotic and that if you just do an upper lid bluff, they're still going to be disappointed with the results. So I think it's really important that we address the brow as part of the unit. When I first started practice, I primarily did endoscopic brow lifts because that's what I was taught in residency. Now that I have my own OR and I no longer have endoscopic equipment, I primarily do subcutaneous brow lifts, which is what I learned from my father because I did join my father in practice in 2007. And to me, that's actually been a very reliable, it's safe and it's simple and it doesn't take a lot of extra, it's not overly time consuming. So it's, to me, it's been actually a very reliable transition. I know a lot of people are also doing different types of brow lifts, including like a lateral gliding brow lift, which has been mentioned at some of the aesthetic meetings, and the hemostatic net, all of which sound interesting, but I kind of like what I'm doing right now. So we'll see.
Do you find yourself doing more temporal brow lifts or coronals, pretracheals? What do you think that you do the most of?
Temporal.
Yeah. And is that really, are you doing them in conjunction with your brows? I mean, with your bluffs?
So primarily, yes, most of my brow lifts are almost 100% in conjunction with my bluffs or with faces or other procedures. They're rarely on their own. I mean, and also the only time that their brows are on their own are potentially when you get that older gentleman who has a super ptotic brow and you can just do a direct excision, but that's not very common either.
Right. What would you say you've learned the most about doing your lower lids? That, you know, is there any practice changers that you've encountered that have made your patients' results better, their recovery better, things like that, that you could advise a younger surgeon?
So I think the thing about the lower lid that's always been scary for most of us is the potential for postoperative complications like scleral show or the prolonged chemosis and dry eye irritation. And I think the game changer for me was there is an oculoplastic surgeon in my community who is a woman who actually trained at UT Southwestern, who's been a very good colleague. And I just reached out to her and after talking to her and discussing what her postoperative protocol was, which included ointment and artificial tears and Tobradex, it's really made a big difference in how I approach my patients. And their postoperative recovery has been smoother. The other thing that I think is critical is how you counsel them beforehand. That if they know what to expect, they respond to the torture a lot better, if you will. I mean, because it is uncomfortable and their eyes are going to be irritated for a certain period of time after surgery. That's almost unavoidable. But if they know to expect that and know that that's part of the healing process, they are going to respond to you and be more tolerant of that process.
Can you talk to me about how fat grafting fits into your surgical technique?
So I think one of probably my weaknesses is I don't always give as much credit to the volume depletion we have as we age. I mean, with my filler patients, I know intuitively to address that issue, but I don't always address it with my surgical patients, and I think that's important. So I think fat grafting to the tear troughs, to the cheeks, and even to the temple area can be a huge game changer in the postoperative result.
Yeah, I agree. I think that my results when I convert from just a bluff to a bluff of fat, it's a dramatic change from the 5-6-step bluff to the 6-step bluff type of conversation. Can you talk to us about how you close your eyelids? Because I think that that has been something for me that I've evolved, and I think that perhaps you have to just...
So for my upper eyelids, my incision is kind of a lazy S that goes to the orbital rim, which might be a little bit longer than what some people do. I don't know. So the first aspect of that, the most lateral aspect of that incision is closed with simple interrupted 6-0 prolines, and then the actual incision is with the pull-out proline running subcuticular, which I just steri-strip the ends to the patient's forehead. For my lower lip lefts, the crow's foot extension on that subciliary incision is closed with the 6-0 proline in the skin. Now, I do have a deep suture for my orbicularis, which is usually a vicryl suture. And then the subciliary part, I just put a couple of 6-0 fast absorbs, but I don't do too many because it can be very irritating. And I really don't think if you get that skin lined up right that you need a suture to close it. And as I said, they all get a temporary tarsorrhaphy, which is usually a 4-0 silk through the lower eyelid. Then I tape it to the forehead with Steri-Strips.
You described that you do essentially like a septal reset with your fat coming back over the rim. Mm-hmm. Do you release the entire orbital retaining ligament before you do that? How do you get that fat into a space where it feels stable?
Yes, I do release it. And then I put the fat in and then I do a subcutaneous suture with the pledget with the 6-0 proline.
Okay. Do you have any issues? I don't do that, but I've thought about doing it. I see a lot of people do it. Do you have any issues with skin breakdown, or are there any extra precautions you need
with
to
the
take
subcutaneous,
with the pledget?
I haven't had issues with any skin breakdown. I use a small piece of Xeroform, and so that's been no problem. The only thing I have had is patients, you know, sometimes they're groggy, sometimes they're medicated, they don't like the stuff on their face, and sometimes they'll scratch it. And that will cause irritation, or they'll act, and with that, because it's a 6-0 proline, sometimes they'll pull it out.
Yeah. It's always learning and growing. I actually have a mentor who is retired. He's one of the guys that started our practice, that he would morselize the fat directly and then re-graft it.
I like that.
It's I never saw it in training, and it's become something that I've done, which has been really interesting to add to my practice. But I'm now playing with just like a pull-out 5-0 proline that's taped to the temples and to the nose, just like my closure stitch. Yeah. And so it's interesting to hear how everybody places the fat to the tear trough, because I feel like that is really the home run part.
That is the home run part. Yeah. The results I've had that I'm happy with are the ones where that's the most critical or the most successful. But I do think, I'm also thinking that in those ones that are not as great, maybe adding a little bit of fat with fat grafting is the right way to go. Mm-hmm. Because that's essentially what we're trying to do, is we're trying to use their own fat so that we don't have to do fat grafting. But
yeah. And that's sort of where I was going with our discussion. And we had a discussion during the symposium about awake versus asleep fat grafting. And I
doing filler, I think, has made me really do my fat differently. And so I love injecting people sitting up, because it's what they actually look like.
It is.
And
I completely agree with you. We look like different people when you're lying down. And when you're trying to assess a patient's face or their eyes when they're lying down, it's very, very tricky and very difficult.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm glad to hear that I'm not the only one.
No, that's also, you know, that's also why I go on my little soapbox about how we look at those immediate postoperative results on Instagram.
Oh, kills me.
On the table, and people look different when they're lying down. That's why aging to our faces, I mean, and to our entire body, is so different when we're upright.
Right. And I think that's also coupled with, I feel like we have such a consumer interest in looking great so soon after surgery. And so you see everyone posting these post-ups that are like, look how good this person looks 2 weeks out. This is a facelift or a bluff 2 weeks out. I'm like, yeah, but I don't really care what they look like 2 weeks out as a surgeon. Like, and I wish we could somehow educate patients about that. It's really 6 months, 12 months, you know, what's your 5-year result? That I wish we had more of that we were showing patients, because I think those are really
I think we've created a whole lot of unrealistic expectations, because patients fail to understand or aren't clearly getting the message that surgery is a process, and that healing and recovery is a process that really takes time.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I'll keep doing my best to post the long-term results. But well, thank you, Anu. It was great to talk with you, and thanks for listening in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the WPS Remix Edition of the Plastic Surgery Hot Seat Podcast, brought to you by the ASPS Women Plastic Surgeons Forum. We hope you found our coverage of the WPS Symposium informative and engaging. Remember to subscribe to our podcast, check out our other episodes on your preferred platform, or download them directly from ASPS EdNet. Stay tuned for more insightful conversations and expert advice to help you navigate the latest trends and challenges in plastic surgery.